Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. The usual two segments today. First, in moments, the geographer Sam Stein will analyze New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio's affordable housing program, a prime example of neoliberal social policy that is actually state-sponsored gentrification in disguise. And at the bottom of the hour, Rachel Price will talk about fiction and the visual arts in contemporary Cuba. First, urban planning, neoliberal style. Bill de Blasio ran for mayor of New York back in 2013 as the avatar of a new approach to the city's politics. Foreshadowing Bernie Sanders, de Blasio campaigned against inequality and the moneyed reign of the billionaire mayor Michael Bloomberg. I was always skeptical about de Blasio. I interviewed him back in the early 1990s when I was writing about the New Party, a quasi-third party that looked to be a scheme to keep progressives bound to an increasingly centrist Democratic Party. He struck me as a not very bright BS artist back then, and nothing he's done since has changed my opinion. My suspicions about his mayoralty were confirmed by his initial round of appointments, notably a real estate guy, Carl Weisbrod, as co-director of his transition team, and then as his economic czar, Alicia Glenn, formerly of Goldman Sachs. And de Blasio's reign has lived up to these initial appointments. High-rises continue to be built, poor people continue to be displaced, and polarization proceeds apace. But people do love their illusions, but not Sam Stein. Sam is a graduate student in geography at the City University of New York, who's written about the fraud that is de Blasio's affordable housing scheme for Jacobin and New Politics. Here he has to look behind de Blasio's record. And although this focuses on New York, it's widely applicable to jurisdictions across the country. Sam Stein. The City Council of New York City passed the rezoning scheme that Bill de Blasio has been pushing for some time. What's in it and what does this mean?
It's basically a zoning program. It's creating new housing by increasing the amount that developers are allowed to build all over the city. And where they increase the development capacity, they say some percent of it has to be at below market rates. And it's mandatory as opposed to a voluntary system. So everything that gets built under these conditions has to have this. But there's a number of problems with the program.
Okay, well, let's talk about those.
The main reasons that people have criticized it are that it doesn't create enough affordable housing. It is something like 70% market rate, 30% affordable. In some places, it's going to be only 20% affordable. So people are saying this is nowhere near the amount of affordable housing we need in this city, which has a severe and historic affordable housing crisis. The other big criticism of it is that the affordable part is not affordable enough. In some places, you're going to be able to build for housing for families making well over the average New York City salary and call it affordable housing, and maybe even get a subsidy to do it. So that's ridiculous. And then the most affordable it gets is an optional a developer's choice to build at what is called 40% of the area median income. That excludes more than a third of the city and almost half of the people of color who live in New York City. So the affordable portion isn't affordable enough. But I've always said that the biggest problem with it is that it ushers in multitudes of rich people into gentrifying neighborhoods at the same time as maybe it's creating a little bit of affordable housing. But it's the luxury part that's going to have the biggest impact. It's going to drive up rents in the surrounding area. And I think we're going to have a net loss in affordable housing because the places where this is being tried out are places where we already have a good deal of affordable housing. And now developers have the incentive to either knock down what's there and build something bigger or build on vacant lots and drive up the property values in the surrounding area. So it's basically a gentrification plan masking as an affordable housing plan.
How do they get to define affordable such that much of the city doesn't even qualify?
The basic mechanism is the area median income, which is set by the federal government and includes New York City as well as several surrounding suburbs, including places that aren't even contiguous with New York City. So Putnam County is included, even though that's a good deal away from New York. And the people who live there make a lot more than the people who live in New York City. So the median income for that whole area is well higher than in the city in general. And even then, if we look at the neighborhoods where they're trying this out, the median incomes there are well lower than the median incomes even in the city. So this is a disproportionately rich population that we're calling the average compared to where these things are being built.
And one of the target neighborhoods for this scheme, I believe we discussed this last time you were on the show, is East New York. Give us the outline of why being in the crosshairs of affordable housing is not so good for East New York.
Yeah, well, East New York is, it's in eastern Brooklyn. It is one of the only places where the percentage of African Americans went up during the Bloomberg era, our last mayor, where when people got displaced from other neighborhoods, a lot of them moved to East New York because it was the last really affordable neighborhood in Brooklyn. The average income there is about $33,000. Meanwhile, the targets for the de Blasio housing plan are much higher than that. I think the lowest is really $40,000, and realistically, it's much more like $50,000 and up. So the people who live in East New York now are not going to be served by the new affordable housing that's being built, and there's going to be a ton of market rate housing, which is going to drive up their rents and housing costs. So they're targeting this plan at one of the poorest neighborhoods, and really one of the only affordable neighborhoods. They could have done the exact opposite and targeted instead rich neighborhoods that have basically no affordable housing. And then this plan would actually make some sense. If they went to places where right now everything that's being built is expensive, market rate, luxury housing, and they said, no, now you have to include some apartments at below market rent, that would be different than the status quo. What they're doing instead is going to a poor neighborhood with a lot of affordable housing and incentivizing more luxury stuff there.
And as you have pointed out in the New Politics piece, merely announcing a rezoning has rather sharp effects on the neighborhood that in question, right?
That's right. And this is true in East New York. It's true in the South Bronx. And it's true in other places outside New York City, too. Zoning is a really important way that municipalities can alter land values. Because what you're saying is what's allowed to be built where and how big it can be. So if you change an industrial area to a residential area, or if you change the residential height cap from, you know, two or three stories up to 10 or 12, you've really handed over the owner of that land a huge amount of money. So as soon as you announce that you're going to rezone, and we know from past practice that that's going to significantly increase property values, landlords start to speculate. They start to harass their tenants into leaving because they can get even more money on an empty building or an empty lot than they can on a fully occupied one. And that's exactly what happened in East New York. The rents have gone up, the housing prices have gone up, and displacement has started there where in the past that was really the refuge of the displaced.
There's an old saying on Wall Street, buy the rumor, sell the news. I guess that works with zoning.
It absolutely does, and anyone in city planning should have known that before they started announcing which neighborhoods were targeted. They could have done quite a bit to protect the people in those places.
Now, of course, if East New York was a recipient of displaced people, are there any neighborhoods left where displaced people can go now?
It's tough. I mean, there's barely anything. We have so little vacancy in our affordable housing stock. We have many years-long waiting lists on our public housing. The vacancy rate for affordable rent-stabilized housing is between 1% and 2%. There's not a lot of places to go. And the places that people would go are the next step on the list for rezonings, the South Bronx, the North Shore of Staten Island. These are places that are currently pretty affordable and the city is actively making more expensive.
Parenthetically, there was a fight among de Blasio, Governor Cuomo, and the building unions over the details of this affordable housing scheme. How did that all shake out?
Well, oddly enough, it may be the savior for people who are worried about this housing plan, but it was over a giant billion-dollar tax abatement that gives money to developers who supposedly build a little bit of affordable housing, maybe keep some of their building rent stabilized, but there was so little asked of them and so little accountability that a lot of times it was just a giveaway to developers. The state decided that they were going to renew this legislation with some minor tweaks if the building trades unions and the developers lobby agreed to some language around how much builders would be paid. Everyone assumed that they would come to an agreement since it was in both groups' interest. The unions want more construction, and obviously the developers do too. But for whatever reason, there was a serious enough impasse that they came to no deal. And now we're in a situation where the law has expired. Everyone assumes that it'll be replaced with something, but no one knows how we'll get there. So that was the main financing mechanism, or one of the main ones, for a lot of the housing that would be built under this plan. If that's not in place, developers may balk at building this inclusionary housing.
Where did this sort of scheming come from? De Blasio ran as the enemy of inequality. You know, he's got this reputation of being the great urban progressive mayor. Yet, you know, it's hard to see at a program like this. Who thought this up?
It's been around for a while. It was tried out in the Bay Area years ago, and nobody really looks there for a model of affordable housing. It's really the only place that can compete with New York for radical inequality and gentrification. But it was done there. It's been done in Denver. It's been done in Boston. It's also pretty popular in Europe, in parts of Latin America. So this is a fast policy trend that's moving around the country. And there are lobbyists who push for it. And they sell it as a win-win for tenants, for developers, for municipalities. And de Blasio drank the Kool-Aid on this years ago. He was pretty friendly to development when he was a city council member. And he didn't really highlight that when he was running for mayor. He highlighted the inequality in the city, but it's not a total shift in position for him now to be supporting new development as the strategy to get affordable housing. He's very close with Forest City Ratner, which is the developer that built the Atlantic Yards project, which promised way more affordable housing than it delivered. He supported a number of rezonings. Apparently, he was also responsible for purging a lot of community boards of opponents to big development when he was a city council member. So this is a pattern of practice. It just doesn't match the image that he's sold of himself.
I remember reading this, and Bob Fitch wrote about this stuff years ago, that urban liberalism in America is very tied up with the real estate industry, right? This is like a fact of American life across the country.
Yeah, I think he called it friendly fire, as in the finance, insurance, and real estate industry has their friends in the nonprofit world who sell finance strategies as the way to do good in the world. And that's absolutely the de Blasio model. Our economic development guru is Alicia Glenn, who comes out of Goldman Sachs. A lot of his closest advisors come from this crossover nonprofit, for-profit world. The head of the Public Housing Authority also comes from a group called Enterprise, which basically sells complicated tax credits for low-income housing development. So this is all a part of the milieu.
Again, speaking of the public housing, what's going on with the scheme to develop all the spare space there for private housing?
Right. So the idea was proposed under Bloomberg. De Blasio opposed it at the time. But what it would do is build new private housing on the open spaces within public housing developments. Sometimes that means building on top of a parking lot, and sometimes it means tearing up a playground and putting this housing in. Under the former mayor, it would have been 80% market rate, 20% affordable. Under de Blasio, supposedly it'll be 50-50. But again, the affordable portion is nowhere near affordable for people who now live in public housing. That plan has moved forward. They promised that they would listen to the voices of public housing tenants and have all these consultation sessions. Those happened for a while, but public housing residents had a tendency to protest at them and to say, this does nothing for us but take away our open spaces. So now they seem to be shutting down that portion and simply moving forward with the plan.
I'm speaking with the geographer, Sam Stein. Now, the public housing system itself, what are the risks of that being somehow privatized?
There's more and more of a move at the federal level to privatize public housing. A lot of it is what was called Hope 6, which is you demolish the housing, you build new mixed-income housing in a scattered way, and maybe half the people who used to live in public housing find their way to Hope 6, and then the other half are not tracked, and we don't know what happens to them. Presumably, they spend a lot of money on housing or may even go homeless. That is not happening in New York to the extent that we know. Instead, what we're looking at is private mechanisms for financing affordable housing. And some of that is this infill development that I was just talking about, where the income from private housing goes into the coffers of the public housing authority. And some of it is actually sort of temporarily selling the properties to private entities who manage them for a while and then give them back to the city when they're on better financial footing. But this is a new program, and we really don't know where it'll lead. And a lot of people are worried that it's going to, if not directly over time, lead to a privatization where nonprofits or even for-profit affordable housing developers have a really large hand in managing public housing. The concern with that is that it's undemocratic. They have a profit incentive, and they don't get to prioritize those with the biggest need. They have a way of skimming out those that they don't want in their housing and giving only this public housing to those who are most likely to be able to pay the rent every single month.
Of course, to be fair to public housing, it's not getting very well funded, right?
No, the federal government is primarily responsible for funding federal housing, and they have been completely absent for decades. So municipalities are the ones who have to deal with the fact that the federal government has been underfunding them. So they have to come up with these creative mechanisms, including temporarily selling off the deeds, including this new development. But the real problem is at the federal level.
And of course, which takes me to another point that the standard response to critics of these sorts of schemes, these market-based schemes, is that there's no alternative. A city can't do much of anything else. They're at the mercy of larger forces. Globalization, of course, but also tight funding at the federal level. Is there something a city like New York can do on its own in such a hostile environment?
There are many things. And I don't want to downplay the hostility of the environment. It is really bad out there. And it is really tough. And it's a problem that is global, like you mentioned. It's also a federal government that doesn't pay for its housing commitments. In New York, we have a state government that has been eating away at our rent laws and our ability to raise taxes over the years. So it's tough. But there are many things that cities can do. And in this New Politics piece, I looked at what New York City could have done to come up with a better result. And I think there's a few steps that are doable in many different cities, not just New York. And the first thing is to stop rezoning. And that's not because the current zoning in a lot of places is so great that it needs to be preserved, but just because, like we were saying before, once you start rezoning and once you start announcing where rezonings are going to be, you stimulate speculation and displacement. So first of all, don't do these spot rezonings announced way in advance, because you're just going to mess up the housing market. The next thing to do is use zoning as a tool to stop harassment and stop displacement. We have something called anti-harassment zoning in one neighborhood of New York City. This was put in the 1970s and has been slightly whittled away over the year, but still works. And it basically says, the city zoning doesn't allow for demolition or gut renovations in any building that has harassed its tenants out of their apartments. So if you can't push your tenants out, there's going to be a lot less of this purely speculative demolition and reconstruction.
Now, parenthetically, there's a whole industry of harassing tenants out, right?
Yes. There are law firms that specialize in this. There are services where you pay someone a little bit of money and they knock on doors. They offer payouts to people who leave. There are private investigators who look up some reason why an apartment's tenancy could be called into question, whether it really should or not. So yeah, there's a big industry of harassment all over the country.
Okay, then back to what the city could do.
Okay, so yeah, freeze rezonings, institute an anti-harassment zoning program, and then community planning really comes into play. Once we've put a damper on the amount of displacement that's going on, communities should be encouraged to create plans that solve their own problems and come up with solutions that work for them. Now, we live in a radically unequal society, so we also need cities to not just allow rich neighborhoods to keep out poorer people and poorer neighborhoods to get more development. There needs to be guidelines that lay out what every neighborhood has to do. But there's a pretty long history of community plans coming up with good solutions to housing crises, transit problems, and other things. So the next thing is about taxes. Cities generally use taxes to stimulate development. That's not usually a good idea in high-value land markets. What they could be doing is putting such high taxes on, for example, vacant properties and vacant apartments that landlords will want to basically sell them off to the city to stop having to pay for this warehousing, or bring in new tenants, which would do something good for the housing market. We can stop giving away billions of dollars to luxury developers in cities that are gentrifying. That's, you know, not something anyone is making us do. And then finally, a lot of cities own a lot of housing, and that's not just public housing. That's also foreclosed properties. It's vacant land that is often just fenced off and people don't have access to it. The best thing to do with that is to transfer it over to a community land trust, which is a model in which one entity owns the land, a different entity owns the building on top of it, and both are committed to long-term affordability. They usually run as limited equity co-ops where you're not allowed to sell your apartment for much more than you bought it for. And often you're supposed to sell it back to someone who is in the income bracket you were in when you bought it. That's a way to do housing in a completely different way than most cities have been doing it. And it wouldn't stimulate massive amounts of development, but it would preserve a lot of affordability. And what was built would be way more affordable than what we're getting right now.
I believe Bernie Sanders did something like that when he was mayor of Burlington, didn't he?
That's right. I think Burlington has the most community land trusts of any place in the city, and it's one of the most successful programs that people who are interested in community land trusts look at. But he wasn't alone either. There were a movement in Berkeley, California did something similar. And even here in New York, we have in the Lower East Side a successful model where Robert Moses, our urban renewal guru, had a plan to knock down a neighborhood. The people of Cooper Square came up with an alternative plan. They pushed it for 50 years, and eventually they won, and now their land is a permanently affordable community land trust. People pay exceedingly low rents by New York City standards, and it really works.
Finally, the policies on housing and other social issues, you know, sort of fit into a two-party model. You know, the Republican model is the hell with it, just like let the market take care of it. The Democratic neoliberal model seems to be let's create a market to take care of the problem. The kinds of housing policies you were laying out are pretty much standard issue Democratic neoliberalism across the country now, aren't they?
Yes, it is a let's make a market approach, and it hasn't resulted in a great deal of affordable housing or housing security. The amounts of evictions in this country are out of control. And so what we really need to be doing is decoupling the idea of affordable housing from the production of luxury housing. And ultimately, we need to be thinking about how to decommodify land in general. As long as land is a commodity that only those with the means have access to, as long as housing is a commodity that only those with means have access to, we're going to have homelessness, we're going to have displacement, we're going to have gentrification. We need to be thinking about what we can do to socialize land and to make housing not just a right, but a genuine social good that everyone has access to.
That was Sam Stein, who's a graduate student in geography at CUNY, who's written about Bill de Blasio's phony politics for Jacobin and New Politics. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break.
Culture waiting for life to end. Hoping to profit, he's nobody's friend. If he gets near, your bones he'll clear. He'll jump your bandwagon till it's your corpse he's dragging. Culture! Executive wants your guts in his grip.
That was some of Vulture from Iggy Pop's new album Post-Pop Depression. Next, Cuba. Obama's visit to that country, with which the U.S. has been effectively at war for over 50 years, introduces a new tone for U.S.-Cuban relations. The long-standing embargo has sealed off Cuba from American eyes. Most of us know little about life there except crude caricature. Rachel Price's book, Planet Cuba, there's a slash between those two words that you can't hear on the radio, looks at the country's culture, notably visual arts and literature, in relation to both internal Cuban life and to the outside world. It was published late last year by Verso. Rachel Price is an associate professor at Princeton, specializing in Latin American culture. Rachel Price. Obama in Cuba, really quite an extraordinary event. What are your impressions of the visit? What did it feel like to someone who knows Cuba and knows America? What do you see to see these things coming together?
I think it is a momentous visit, and I actually thought it was really a remarkable speech that he gave today. Yesterday, Obama and Raul both gave a joint press conference, which was notable just because it hasn't been done before. But I thought the speech today was particularly significant because of some of the topics that Obama touched on. He mentioned the sort of shared history of slavery between Cuba and the U.S. and challenges having to do with racial discrimination in both places. He asked the U.S. to end the embargo. He pushed Cuba on questions of human rights, but he also reiterated that any change that happens in Cuba comes from Cuba and that the U.S. is not there to impose anything. And he also, something that really struck me is he recognized the need for reconciliation between Cuban Americans and Cubans. And that's something that hasn't been as big a part of the conversation at this level so far.
Now, of course, this is reckless generalizations, but what are your understandings of how Cubans feel towards the United States? We've been at an embargo on the country for 5 decades. It's been pretty hellish in a lot of ways because of the embargo, but there also seems to be a lot of connection and... Yeah. Fascination. How did you characterize that?
It's part of a long-standing relationship that predates, of course, the revolution and the embargo. And so I think there have been ongoing ties. I always think of the two countries as sort of co-productions of one another. So sometimes people today are afraid of the invasion of Americans. I've heard this a lot when I'm talking about my book, and I say
commercial, you know, not Bay of Pigs style. Right.
Right. Exactly. Cruise ships, which actually have just gotten clearance. But I think, you know, there's this long relationship that really, there was never any isolation in terms of cultural exchanges, in terms of shared cultural interests. Another thing to keep in mind is that since the revolution, there have been Cubans living here in the U.S., so there's always been exchanges between Cuban Americans and Cubans. So So what are the feelings by many Cubans towards the U.S.? I think it's mixed, as you can expect, but I think there's a lot of warmth or a sense of proximity in terms of a shared history.
You capture this in your book's title, Planet / Cuba. It's a small country, of course, but of enormous global influence. After Jeffrey Goldberg made his visit to Cuba last year with someone for the Council on Foreign Relations, Julia Zweig, I listened in on a press conference that they gave, a phone press conference. And Goldberg, who is not the most progressive person politically, remarked on what an enormous figure Castro was and how he had just been such a world historical figure for 50 years and really, you know, had captured the world's attention. This small country.
Right.
How did that happen? I mean, it is just a little island off the United States. What? Why does it have this kind of global impact?
And actually, just to add there, that's something I appreciated again in Obama's speech today, is he also recognized that world historical importance. He said, Cuba is an island nation, but it's also a place that has been incredibly influential and will hope to continue to be, and he understood that. I think it has to do with Cuba's actual geographical position. So it was always an important stepping stone for different imperial designs. And it was also became one of the wealthiest islands after the Haitian Revolution because it took over the sugar industry once the Haitian Revolution abolished slavery. That slavery was continued in Cuba and it became the biggest sugar producer. So there was always wealth throughout the 19th century, and that wealth also meant institutions. So it was this kind of double-edged sword of like the most horrific slavery at the same time that there was this great investment on the part of Spain in the island. So I think that set a history of a kind of institutions. In terms of its world historical importance in the 20th century, it became a model for Latin America, the Cuban Revolution in the early years, and then beyond, obviously, Latin America, Asia, and Africa. Even into the Angolan War, Cuba sent, I think, I'm not sure about the number, but I think it's 200,000 troops to the Angolan Wars.
I think we're just celebrating the 20th anniversary or 25th anniversary of that Cuito Carnavale battle.
So I think that has a lot to do with its world historical importance. Also, another point that was made today in the speech by Obama, who made sure to invite Cuban doctors into the salon where he was speaking, was the role of Cuban doctors in international missions.
Turning to your book, I was struck. Despite my politics, I guess I incorporated a lot of conventional American attitudes towards the island, that it was sort of sealed off from the outside world, and cultural expression was perhaps somewhat constrained by that. What you portray is a world of artists and writers who are very much aware of global trends, very much incorporating styles and genres that, you know, the most advanced arts and writing in the world. How did these relations with the outside get carried on? How did Cubans engage with what was going on elsewhere?
Well, there's different moments. So one of the most important moments in Cuban art history happened in the 1980s. It's a generation associated with an art show that was called Volume 1, Volumen Uno. And those artists had different access to international contacts, including the important figure of Ana Mendieta, who was a Cuban-American artist who went back to Cuba in those years and sort of introduced Cubans and American artists to one another. So she played an important role. But at the same time, Cubans also had access to magazines, to international art fairs. The beginning of the biennial, I think it was 1984, the Havana Biennial, which was an important gesture towards creating a different kind of biennial that was not the Venice Biennial model. But then after the 1990s, Cuban artists also began circulating more. You know, they've been going to residencies in China, in Europe, in the United States. And there have been international figures who go to the Cuban art schools. So that's one way this exchange has happened.
The first couple of chapters of your book about the use of plant metaphors.
Mm-hmm.
First, we're sick of the rhizome, and the importance of the tree. The tree is rather important to the Cuban imagination, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's something that I was sort of surprised to find, but when you think about it, it makes sense given the long history of sugar on the island. So there's always been this tension between sugar and deforestation and trees and sort of a kind of counter-imaginary to sugar. One thing I mentioned in the book was, in my research, I found this fascinating journal from the 1930s called Cuspide, which was a an arts and culture, but also politics journal that was really dedicated to reforestation and to non-sugar environments. And the most interesting aspect of it, or one of them, besides the fact that it was accompanied by major reforestation programs, was that it was also published from within a sugar mill. So the person who directed the magazine was also the manager for four sugar mills. So there's always been this tension between sugar and other environments.
But he wasn't taking the company line.
No, no. But at the same time, he was running those four mills.
The forest had to be cleared to make way for the sugar, right? And that Cubans seemed very aware of ecological effects of that. You know, I think it seems Americans don't really think about that sort of thing very much, but it seemed, from at least from reading your book, that it was very much in the minds of Cubans, going back decades, what the ecological impact of this transformation was.
Yes, I think so.
But then there's that that shrub, which
Marabou.
Marabou, yes. What's that like?
Well, you know, it's something that I hadn't been aware of myself until I came across it in art, and then I saw it everywhere. So marabou is a non-native species that was introduced into the island in the 19th century. And it was always a bit of a struggle for farmers who were trying to keep their fields clear of it. But it really became an invasive problem in the post-Soviet period. On the one hand, because petroleum was used to some degree to get rid of, to eradicate the roots, and petroleum sort of disappeared for a while with the end of the Soviet Union. It was a major supplier for Cuba. But also because the sugar industry has been almost entirely closed in the last 10 years. So fields that had been dedicated to sugar have now been overrun with marabou. So it's become more of a visible presence and a metaphorical presence for artists.
Yeah, what's the metaphor about?
The metaphor actually varies. So in several works that I found, the metaphor was, or the symbol of marabou, was an example of sort of failed agricultural policies, or else either the omnipresence of the state or the failure of the state to actually realize a kind of functioning agricultural sector. But I look at one work by two artists. One is Cuban-American, one is Cuban, but based now in Miami. And their work was actually imagining marabou as a much more protean example of, on the one hand, digital aesthetics, the way things are multiplied, the way that marabou shows up in the background unwittingly of some digital news shows, but also as an example of invasive economic systems, kind of global capitalism on the island.
This was a post-Soviet phenomenon, the proliferation of the marabou metaphor?
Yes. I mean, I only saw it in the last few years myself, uh-huh. Sort of 2005 onwards, uh-huh. Which so probably has more to do with the end of the sugar industry.
Yeah, so the Cubans now have shut down sugar, or pretty close to it?
For the most part, yeah.
And why is that? It was a big earner of money, wasn't it?
It was a big earner of money through the 1980s. At some point, the Brazilians eclipsed the Cubans in terms of both sugar and ethanol production. I don't know exactly the true reasons for the closure of the sugar industry. I know when Fidel Castro spoke of closing it, he mentioned its nefarious roots in slavery. But I think it may have had more to do with the changing investments on the part of the government towards a service economy.
I'm speaking with Rachel Price, author of Planet Cuba from Verso. So what did that, at the end of the Soviet subsidy era, had an enormous influence on the economy, went from a relative golden age to great deprivation. How was that reflected in changes in artistic interests?
Well, that whole period following the fall of the Soviet Union is known as the special period in Cuba, the special period in times of peace, as opposed to a wartime special period. And it was just marked by incredible scarcity. In terms of art and literature, it's something that I was actually moving beyond in this book, because it really produced, on the one hand, a looking outwards, because Cuba was suddenly not part of this Soviet system, but at the same time, it was really, I would say, a looking inwards towards the peculiarities of the strange post-Soviet movement. So you got a lot of attention to groups that hadn't been given space before, groups whose sort of subcultures, right, that didn't have any attention before. That was a real obsession in the part of literature, for example. There's an attention to the strange kind of inventiveness that Cubans had to resort to in order to survive the scarcity. And so it became a very kind of particular vision of Cuba. And I think now we're seeing something that's much more global in its taste and in its concerns.
Yeah, well, that, I guess, was in some sense a period of an isolation. But now Cuba is being exposed to global capital. Mm-hmm. What's that doing to the artistic consciousness?
Well, I mean, just a reminder that Cuba actually opened to foreign direct investment around 1991. So what's recent is U.S. interest and capital. But, you know, Europe and anywhere else has always been able to do that since 1991. What is the recent change with the U.S. normalization doing to art and literature? Coincidence or not, we have seen in the last 5 years a whole spate of new independent galleries that didn't used to exist. There's the first international gallery, which has opened a building in Havana, which has no precedent so far until this past November, I think it was. There's a lot more circulation, a lot more curators and gallerists going to Cuba. There's more Cubans being shown in galleries here in New York, for example. So there just seems to be more circulation in general.
What are the economics of these galleries going back, you know, to earlier times? Were they part of the foreign exchange economy or domestic thing, or how is it all financed?
Since the so-called special period, artists were a special group that were able to travel when other people had to ask for permission to leave the island. They always circulated more, and they were able to earn in dollars, paying taxes to the Cuban government, but they were able to sell in other currencies. And now a lot of those economic hurdles have been removed for in general, not just for artists. Cuba has a long tradition of a kind of art scene that's not about the market. And so a lot of these more independent galleries have as their goal not necessarily a market, or not necessarily selling so much as exhibiting different works.
You said there's a distinction during the classical period of Cuban socialism between professional artists and amateurs, right? There was professionals had a certain status as workers that amateurs didn't. What did that mean for the artistic life?
Well, artists were asked to join the Union of Artists and Writers.
Sort of curious about the career path of an artist. So what?
Cuba has a very strong sort of feeder system. So people who show artistic talent or interest are encouraged to go to different art schools, and they go pass through different systems in the provinces, and then sort of the best artists end up going to the Superior Art Institute.
And the state has encouraged this all along?
Yes, the state has always been very encouraging, very supportive of the arts, very promoting of the arts.
And what about content? Were they like looking for some kind of crude socialist realism, or are they more adventurous than that?
There was a brief moment of socialist realism in the 1970s, which is known as the gray period, the gray five-year period, which some people say was 15 years. But the arts have always had more space, more leniency, but there's also always been censorship and self-censorship. So you see it all.
With the self-censorship, what were people afraid of? Were they afraid of prison or isolation or what?
I think it's always been a range. I mean, there's, afraid of isolation, but also of prison.
The second half of your book, you write a bit about these rather striking dystopian science fiction novels and stories, and some art as well. It seems that Cuba is gradually entering a capitalist world that looks to be falling apart with recurrent economic and especially ecological crisis. And this weighs very heavily on the consciousness of Cuban artists, right? Yeah, tell us about some of these. The Underwater Havana.
Havana Underwater is a novel by Eric Mota, which was published last year. You know, Cuban science fiction has always drawn both on the U.S. and the Soviet traditions of science fiction. So they're very familiar with the different kinds of dystopias that have been presented throughout the 20th century. And this is a novel that it's quite humorous, and it imagines a future Havana that's half underwater because of global climate change. And there's also sort of no more states. There's no more U.S.
The U.S. is a total wreck.
The U.S. is a wreck. Cuba is warring fiefdoms connected to petroleum platforms. The Vatican has been privatized. It's really kind of a...
Parenthetically, there's finding oil has been one of the great hopes of Cuba, right?
Right.
Economically speaking, but then...
Throughout the 20th century.
The meaning of oil then is frightening.
Well, you know, I just think one of my arguments in the book is about the kind of getting past this division between a Cuban perspective and a global perspective, and understanding that Cubans are part of the global conversation, which means that they can care about climate change or not in the same way that people can be convinced, be...
A country that has contributed almost nothing to a problem.
Right.
So what happens in this underwater Havana?
So in the underwater Havana, Afro-Cuban religion has been melded with the internet. So the Orishas live in the internet and guide evil and positive quests for different special powers and so on. It's very much inspired by video game culture as well. I know the author himself is a hacker and a video game aficionado, so I think that really informs it.
How are they fixed for hardware?
How are they fixed for hardware?
Yeah.
Well, in the novel, it's a real gamut from the most primitive to the most advanced technologies, which in a way is a kind of comedic commentary on the way that Cubans themselves, under very hard conditions, have managed to make incredible inventions. I once was working in Cuba and my Mac power cord broke, and I thought, what am I going to do? And I went to the version of the Cuban eBay, Revolico, and an hour later there was somebody at my apartment with the missing part. So there's this kind of...
Well, they've kept all those American cars going for 50 years, right?
Right.
Now Google is coming in with internet now, right?
Yes. Yeah, so I just saw this recently, today actually, that Google is installing a very speedy internet in the art space that the artist Cacho has established. So he set up a space in a sort of a poor neighborhood in which he already has made available free internet. It's a little bit off the beaten path. And now Google's going in there. I think the studio is going to be called Cacho and Google.
Just like Bushwick, where the artists are leading the gentrification. And then there's a novel about a highway, right? The Autopista.
Yes, this is a young author who I think is really interesting, Jorge Enrique Laje. That novel, The Highway, the movie is the title, was from 2014. He since has even a newer novel sort of about that takes place in the post-normalization period. But The Highway, the novel, is a kind of cyberpunk novel, like a lot of his work, that the premise is just that we're with a ragtag group of people as they make a documentary about the making of a highway. And this highway, it clearly takes place in Cuba, or it's being built in Cuba, but it extends far beyond Cuba into the Atlantic. The Galapagos Islands has been paved over. Again, this is a future dystopian world. There's climate change, increasing hurricanes. And you encounter a lot of historical figures along the way, from Chinese premiers to people who testified in the hearings about Guantanamo and so on.
Oh, then there's, you have an image in the book of Obama on a piece of American currency with Chinese writing on it.
Yes.
Like, this is part of this dystopic melding of things that are falling apart.
Well, I'm not even sure it's necessarily dystopic so much as it is a kind of just realist examination of the forces that are driving the world today.
Well, this country that was, you know, nominally socialist for 50 years and had many accomplishments and many disappointments, now, you know, it's really been opening up to the world of capital for the last 20 years, and certainly now the U.S. involvement is going to accelerate that. Mm-hmm. What do people think? I mean, what's their attitude towards, you know, the socialist-capitalist conflict now?
Well, first of all, my own feeling would be that it hasn't been socialist for a long time, and that there's very little of any kind of welfare state there right now. So I think most people are basically interested in being able to have functioning careers, functioning businesses. I think there's a lot of excitement about some kind of change. There's also apprehension.
But then all the dystopia about climate change,
right,
and disaster, that's the doing of the capitalists. So how do they evaluate that?
You know, I think there's like a really complex attitude towards the history that Cuba itself has lived through the last 50 years. There's so much disillusion, anger, frustration with Cuba's own government that I don't think artists and writers are necessarily interested in endorsing the way that their own government has framed this kind of standoff. I think they're really interested in finding their own relationship to history and to political economy. So for example, you can get anti-capitalist groups within Cuba, like Observatorio Crítico, which is a group that says, we want more socialism. What we have here is not socialism. Then you have groups that want full market economy. I think there's really a desire for something other than the current government. At the same time, I think we're seeing a reformist moment where people also really just want changes in their welfare. I don't think they're interested in regime change or so, per se. They just want, you know, to be able to have businesses, to be able to not have to emigrate.
But at the same time, there's a huge and growing gap between rich and poor.
Yes, and I think that's something people are very afraid about. They're seeing it intensify in the last few years, and they're worried about what these new economic reforms and changes might do to exaggerate that.
And then, so what does the arrival of the American president contribute to that feeling?
Well, I'm actually going there tomorrow, so I'm very interested to see how it's being received there. I think that there's been a lot of, maybe even too much, hope and optimism invested in the visit by Obama. Despite this long history of U.S. imperialism and presence in the region, I think there's a kind of investment in the potential for change that Obama could represent. So, something you might not expect, given that history.
I think a lot of Americans thought that in 2008.
Exactly.
Somewhat disappointed. Yeah. All right, thanks a lot.
Sure.
That was Rachel Price, author of Planet Cuba from Verso. Her day job is as an associate professor in the Department of Spanish and Portuguese Languages and Cultures at Princeton. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, a bit of 1980s power pop from the Primitives, perhaps in the ludic spirit of contemporary Cuban artists. Till next week, bye.